I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand. And donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Ashley Stewart, journalist with Global News. Hello.
Hi.
Today on the show, we're going to talk about the mass murder that a lot of people have already forgotten about. And Hurricane Fiona. How did that feel? Bad? Probably pretty bad, right? Ashley, welcome to the show. Today's episode is brought to everybody by Diana Hutzelak-Alonzo, Brent Lauman, Bridget Huard, Timothy Hughes, Emily Mass, Riley Smith, Juliet Balfour, and Jeffrey.
I'm Jeffrey, a mortgage broker from Toronto. I support Canada Land because they make Canadian news worth listening to. With guests that actually give their opinions, shows that actually say something about our world, and hearing Jesse talk shit about the news, it all keeps me coming back for more.
I lost my husband and my dad, too.
The widow of one of the suspects of the James Smith Cree Nation stabbings, Skye Sanderson, wife of Damien Sanderson, is now fighting to clear her husband's name and for accountability. Skye Sanderson says she reported her husband and his brother, the other suspect, Miles Sanderson, to police 24 hours before the stabbings took place.
Ashley, we have a feature that we'll get to later on the show where we duly note news stories that deserve more attention, stories that people might have missed. You reported an exclusive story that I think a lot of people might have missed, but it is not a story that's going to fit in a small notation. It's just a few weeks since we had one of the worst mass murders in Canadian history. And reporters from all over the world descended on James Smith Cree Nation in Saskatchewan. They were not welcome on reserve, and pretty soon reporters flew home. And then the Queen died, and then it seems to me that Canadian media kind of moved on from this horrible story. But you stuck around in Saskatchewan, and you've now reported a very long feature story for Global News. You've put a lot of facts, a lot of new information on the record, but you've also kind of written, as no one else has, about what happened during those awful hours in more detail than we've gotten anywhere else. It's a real examination of this community and what it's going through, and I think how they were failed by the police. It's a very long story that I encourage people to read, all of it, but maybe you could summarize what you learned and how you learned it.
Yeah, it does need a summary because it is very long. It is a half an hour read, so it takes some real slog. You're completely right. A lot of people kind of moved on after the Queen died, and we lost a lot of readers on this. But I stayed around in Saskatchewan because the one thing that we were missing this entire time was what actually happened that night. I think we had a lot of small stories about isolated incidents and isolated people that died, but no idea how to link them together. So basically, I just stayed and tried to get to know the people that were at the center of it. And they were the ones that kind of helped me fill in the blanks. So the story starts months before the murders. We've used a lot of narrative to tell the story. So the central part of our story is Sky Sanderson. She's Damien's wife, who tells us about the background to her and Damien's relationship. She says that he was violent towards her. He had substance abuse issues. They both did. They have three children, but she really describes him as kind of a family man who shouldn't be considered a suspect. He should be considered a victim. And that is what we heard time and time again from speaking to other people on the reserve. So Sky talks about the fact that Miles came down after he was released from prison, and he's got this kind of hold over his brother, right? So his brother was afraid of him a lot of the time. Miles started feeding Damien drugs. He was very manipulative, and he came down the week of the murders and kind of took Damien away from his family, supposedly feeding him more drugs. The two brothers went out the night before the murders. They were intimidating people across the reserve. We have several people who saw that or were with them the day before. One person said that they were looking to beat up gang members. And then Sky said that she called RCMP 24 hours before the murders because she was worried that the brothers would do something stupid. Miles had beaten up his partner the morning before the murders. Damien and Miles had taken Sky's car to go and cool Miles off, whatever that means, and Sky then lost contact with Damien. So she hadn't heard from him for a long time. She called the RCMP to get them to help her find her car and find the brothers. Both of them had outstanding arrest warrants, but the RCMP showed up. They found her car, but they didn't do enough to locate Damien or Miles, according to Sky. So we all know what happened next. 24 hours later, 10 people were dead, 18 people were injured, and it was one of the worst killings in Canada's history. And Sky kind of talks about what happened after, why she thinks she was failed by police. We speak to people who were injured themselves in the attacks. They were stabbed. And then I stayed around for a couple of the funerals and spoke to a lot of people about how that healing and grieving process is going to go and what needs to happen next, because obviously it's not over yet. It's going to be a very long, long road for people out there. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
You did a great job. There's so much more to it, so it's not an easy thing to condense. I think that, you know, one thing that's conveyed is you give the people involved a lot of humanity in the telling, and you sort of describe, and especially Damien, and I think there's still questions about his involvement, but the way that the community understands him as a troubled person, but like an active member, one of theirs, a dad, and reframing this notion of these two brothers on this joint killing spree. There's a lot, but there's a couple things. And you know, I think you and your editors identified that there was news value to what you learned. Same as with Portepique, the question is, did police do everything they could have done? Could they have reacted sooner? These are important questions because we, of course, want to like learn something from this so it doesn't happen again. To learn that the cops got a 911 emergency call 24 hours before this murder spree is something that I was shocked to read and was shocked that I only read it in your story. I mean, every news organization in this country was covering this mass killing. This is important new information, but I haven't seen anybody even do a follow. If you were getting this news from Globe and Mail or CBC and you heard about the killings on those news sources, you would not know this new piece of information because as far as I can tell, we've been searching and as we record today, they have not followed up. Why do you think that this is kind of like what's going on? Why has this story only been reported by Global? And I think there was one French media source that picked it up as well.
I mean, I can't speak to why other media outlets haven't followed up. I mean, that decision, I guess, lies with them. But I would assume it's a very, very difficult story to tell, right? Because as you said before, we were not welcome on the reserve to begin with. There were cars driving around on those first couple of days of James Smith members saying, get off, you're not welcome here. So I think that turned a lot of people off. It's also extremely nerve-wracking to go out on a limb and say something like this. I mean, this is a big revelation. So we've basically reported the fact that the RCMP failed here. And it's very difficult because the RCMP are not giving anything away. They've refused to comment on this. They've refused to answer any of the questions, well, most of the questions that I put to them a week earlier. We gave them a full week to respond. So the only way we've been able to kind of corroborate this story is to go and speak to as many people in the community as we could, saying, did you see the RCMP here? What did they say? What happened? Can you kind of corroborate the story that Sky is telling us? So I don't know if it's kind of an idea that other media outlets are, I don't know, are nervous about reporting it as fact. I mean, RCMP haven't commented. I really don't know.
I mean, I'm speculating here, but I know that when news organizations do a follow, they want to recreate the reporting for themselves, independent confirmation. And I could see them running into a wall there because you took the time. How long were you out there?
I was there for 2 weeks. I was readying to go. It was the Friday after the murders, and I was about to go get a flight home, and I got a call from one of the family members saying, well, do you want to come to the funeral on Tuesday for Gloria Burns? And I mean, it's very difficult because, as you said before, the Queen died just as all of the media had arrived for this press conference, the one and only press conference that the James Smith leadership did. And the Queen died during that press conference. So we all, well, I mean, I had this sinking feeling like no one is going to care anymore, you know? And that's, it's bad, but it's also good because I knew that a lot of journalists were going to leave. But also, like, I knew that the public were just going to stop reading this stuff because they were, you saw the coverage of the Queen's death. It was wall-to-wall Queen everywhere. There was nothing else. So I stayed for 2 weeks in the end because after I was invited to that funeral, the chief then invited me to a suite and to like get to know him and the community. So it's just one thing after another. Like these doors, if you just invest the time, these doors keep opening. And it was very difficult to begin with because I felt like every single door was shut and I was running into wall after wall. And it was extremely, extremely frustrating. It was one of the most frustrating stories I've ever worked on. And that's kind of saying something because I've just come from Ukraine. So all I can say is that it was about investing time, and you're completely right. I think if other media outlets had tried to do it, I mean, a lot of these people just wouldn't speak to anyone else, and that sounds very narcissistic, but it's more just the fact that they saw me around the reserve for 2 weeks. They knew who I was. They were more willing to speak to me because they saw me and knew my face than if some random person had just called them up.
And if they at other newsrooms read your story and then wanted to call Sky Sanderson to just confirm what she had told you, I don't know if they would get a call back because they did not invest that time and build the trust that you did. And I could see newsroom decisions saying, well, rather than say, as reported by Global News, you know, we can't independently confirm this. It's not our exclusive. Let's just forget it, which I think is a real broken process in our news gathering. I mean, that is a failure to news readers. Ashley, there's a whole complicated discourse about who tells these stories, about how to report on trauma especially, but on Indigenous issues at all. And ideally, it's Indigenous journalists involved. That's not always possible, and you're responsible for your reporting. I think that the main thing is you don't want to be an exploitative reporter who parachutes in and parachutes out. If you are going to be telling these stories, it's about investing the time and making the relationship and rebuilding trust with communities that have lots of reason to distrust the press. I think what you've achieved here is something that it doesn't seem like any other reporter has. It seems to me that you have done that kind of reporting. I want to move on to actually just deal with what you uncovered here and what the implications of it are, because this to me reveals such a glaring double standard. I mean, if this were to happen, if I were to call 911 and say, hey, there are two wanted men in my neighborhood. They both have rap sheets. They are both known to you. One in particular is a violent criminal that you've been looking for. They're here. They're here. And they stole my car, and they are drunk and dangerous, and I'm afraid they're going to hurt somebody. It would be pretty shocking to me if the police showed up, found my car, poked around a little bit for them, and then said, sorry, we can't find them, and went home. I mean, that would fall well below the standard of protection that most Canadians, I think, expect from police. What was different here?
I mean, this is the question that I've been trying to answer this entire time. It's the question that lies at the crux of this story that is still unanswered, right? So, I mean, the fact that even before this 24-hour call, that Damien had an outstanding warrant from 2021 and Miles had fallen out of touch with his parole officer, but both of them were hiding in plain sight. They weren't in hiding. They were at home. It wouldn't have been very hard for the police to arrest them. Damien was at home with his family on the reserve. Miles was at home in Saskatoon, traveling between James Smith and Saskatoon the entire time. It's not like they were hiding from the police, you know? So yeah, you're completely right. It does seem like a glaringly, it's a double standard. And I don't understand why the RCMP came out. This is obviously Sky's story, which has been corroborated by a couple of other people on James Smith. But they went into this house where they found the car. They went downstairs. They asked the people that were there, are you Damien or Miles? And Damien was there, supposedly. Damien told the RCMP that he gave his cousin's name, apparently, and the cops just kind of took that as fact and then left. He did have an outstanding arrest warrant, obviously. He had a picture that was attached to that. Apparently, he gained a lot of weight since then, so that could explain why he wasn't recognizable. But still, there was just no duty of care there to even take it a bit further and look around the reserve a bit more, supposedly. I mean, we don't know if the cops did any more to try and locate him because they won't speak to us. So this is the problem that we're running into, is that from Sky's point of view, it seems like a massive failure. If there's more to the story, then the RCMP needs to tell us, but they won't.
That is outrageous. And I remember in the early hours that the RCMP released two mugshots, and almost instantly there were people on Twitter saying, Damien does not look like that anymore. Here's a more current picture of Damien. Like, this is a small community, and everybody knew Damien. It was only a cop who doesn't live there who would be face-to-face with Damien. Supposedly, he's on a manhunt for Damien, and he's face-to-face with the guy, and anybody else in that community would be able to say, that's Damien right there, you're speaking to him. But the cop doesn't know that because he's, like, put on some weight, and he doesn't know the people he's policing. I think we gotta also point out, like, this is the Mounties. There is a history between this particular police force and Indigenous people. These are the cops. These are the agents of the state who, like, wrested babies out of mothers' arms. Like, there is a long history of pretty much every kind of abuse that you can think of. So there are trust issues that I think impair people's ability to expect fairness or to cooperate with the police in ways that we would otherwise expect. I mean, there are First Nations that have their own police. I wonder if that isn't another lesson of this. There are police who live in the communities that they police. And in rural Saskatchewan, that is not the case in this community. Do you think that's one of the issues that's raised by your story?
I think so. And also, like, we can't exonerate the several of the community members here. I mean, where Damien was supposedly hiding, there were two people there that were hiding him or harboring him, or they were in his house and they didn't give him up either. So there are deeper issues there. The issue of tribal policing is one that Chief Wally Burns has now taken up and is really pushing hard. Like, that is basically one of the main solutions he sees here, is we need tribal policing and we're not going to settle for anything less than that. Like, they also want, like, dedicated rehabilitation centers on the reserve, because it's obviously a very entrenched problem that a lot of the people that live there do have substance abuse issues. And this has been, a lot of people are saying that this is kind of a symptom of the residential schools.
It's infuriating that the police will not comment on this, but I have heard these justifications before. I have heard these arguments made, you know, that we get called for domestic abuse and substance abuse related stuff so often. The distances are so far. We're so under-resourced. How are we to know when one call is going to be the call that, you know, there's going to be a mass murder afterwards? What they're saying in a different way is, yes, we do treat this differently because they're Indigenous. I think there's, like, a practical consideration that I can try to remain somewhat open-minded to. But you know, the bottom line is still the same, which is I can expect so much more protection and service from police than Indigenous people can. A broken record here, because it seems that every story about the RCMP leads to the conclusion we need to really be thinking about the future of the RCMP itself and who polices all of these various communities. But this takes me back to killing of Colton Bushy. Something is very, very broken. And I hope we don't forget about this story. And I appreciate the work you put into keeping this in people's minds.
Thank you. I mean, I appreciate the response to this story. It's been huge. The amount of people that have been reading it to the end in a world where we are captivated by things for 30 seconds at a time and that's it is amazing. So, yeah, I think that the readership, it's given me a bit of hope in long-form journalism still.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter, like, seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Ashley, as mentioned, we want to point out stories that people might have otherwise missed. It's called Duly Noted. Do you have something to duly note today?
I do. I'm going to be a bit self-serving with this because I have spent a lot of my last few months in Ukraine and I was due to go back, but obviously Saskatchewan took prominence. So I think in the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of competing news stories and a lot of them have fallen by the wayside. One of those, I think, is the liberation of a lot of villages around Kharkiv. We have phenomenal Ukrainian journalists there who are obviously covering what's going on. We have a fixer who we worked very closely with. Her name is Anna Vlasenko. She's over there at the moment doing the job that we cannot do because we're tied up. But also, I mean, it's very easy for Western journalists to kind of parachute in and out of these things. We should be kind of holding the Ukrainian journalists over there. We should be holding them up and supporting their work anyway. So she's done an amazing job of telling the story of the liberation of Dobrova in Ukraine and Izium. She's written up a big piece on Global News about a woman whose son and husband were taken away and tortured in the days before the village's liberation. I mean, these kind of stories are just so heartbreaking that, I mean, we're not seeing the half of them anymore. If it was Bucha or Irpin, I remember when the stories about the mass graves came out then, and it was hugely global. Everyone cared. It was front page news everywhere. These mass graves are found in Izium, and most people have completely switched off. I mean, the readership on our site from anything in Ukraine at the moment, I mean, it's a sweeping generalization. Every so often they break through, but it's paltry. You can tell people have kind of just switched off. So I would encourage everyone to keep reading about Ukraine, to kind of stay connected to what's going on there. Like, I mean, the story about this woman in this liberated village, she lost her husband and her son, and her daughter and another female member of her family are missing for 10 days. So it's just insanely heartbreaking stuff that is just being swallowed by the news cycle. So I think everyone needs to keep eyes on Ukraine right now.
Duly noted. That wasn't self-serving. This is self-serving. I'm going to duly note
a super self-serving story. And this, I even, it's so self-serving, I have to do a disclosure. This is a publisher's note. It's about stuff that I've been lobbying for. I have skin in the game, a dog in the fight. Several other disgusting analogies would also likely apply. But oh my God, Ashley, Parliament is currently debating the Online News Act, Bill C-18. This is quite literally the future of our industry, of the Canadian press, that is being decided by a committee of MPs. And there's just no coverage of this. There's just no reporting thus far. Perhaps that'll change by the time people hear this. But there has not been any coverage by media of the C-18 hearings. And it is barely being mentioned in our press. All across this country, news people are following this very closely because this has to do with whether or not, you know, we exist or not. And I found there's one article in the Star, and there's been two small, pretty much buried articles, kind of just like glancing attention that this is happening. I think that they are probably hoping that this just gets shoved through. They have a consensus amongst themselves, amongst legacy news in Canada. They have the Liberal government on side. Heritage does not want to change a word in this bill. But there are over 100 of us independent online news publishers who are very concerned about this bill for self-interested purposes, because the bill is crafted in such a way that it could shut out a lot of us. And by the way, I don't think Canada Land would be shut out by the criteria, but smaller organizations would be shut out by this. If you own your own small news organization, you could get shut out. And there's all kinds of problems with this. There's no transparency. Like, we won't know which news is funded by Google or Facebook, or how much money any particular news organization is getting from Google or Facebook, unless changes are made to this bill. There's a huge problem in trust. People talk about the news crisis, about, you know, the financial crisis of news. There's also a trust crisis in news. I can't think of anything more toxic to trust in news than introducing into the ecosystem the reality that some unknown level, it's estimated 20 to 30%, but who knows, of media that you're getting, like 20, 30% of the salaries of the reporter is covered by Google or Facebook. Like, if there's anybody who people trust less than journalists, it's Google and Facebook. So like, if we're going to do this thing, if we're going to have this payment scheme, we have to have transparency. We got to know how much money is going to who. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. We have penned an open letter about this, and we're lobbying for changes that I think are good for newsreaders and, yes, good for us independent news publishers. But my God, there's like a near news blackout. It's a gray out on this stuff. It's barely getting mentioned in the press. Perhaps that will change soon. But I did want to duly note it.
I mean, it's a great point. But also, do you not think that that just speaks to the problem at the heart of all of this, is that we're so under-resourced, we can't cover everything?
You mean maybe it's not a conspiracy? Maybe there's just...
It's just speaking to the heart of the problem. Duly noted.
Ashley, devastating impact of Hurricane Fiona. Here is how that sounded on CBC's The Current.
We went down and went through some of the rubble, and my son was able to find some of these hockey medals and some mementos. And we did get, you know, a few things, you know, for our memories. Some pictures were on the wall on one side of the home that we salvaged and stuff, but everything else is gone.
What was that like to go and sift through what was left?
What was that like? What was that like to go and sift through what was left of your house? It was fucking great, Matt. It was awesome. I had a great time, a swell old time, sifting through the rubble of my existence to see if I could find some old family photos. Putz, what was it like? That's your question? It sucked. It was terrible. But he doesn't care what it was like. What happened next, I'm not going to play it for you. It's pure trauma porn. She cries. She breaks down and cries. And he says, I'm sorry. And it's this ritual. I'm sorry. I like Matt Galloway. I think he's a terrific broadcaster. What is with this? He's done it before. Let's play this other one. This is what Matt Galloway asked after a fire wiped out the town of Lytton, BC.
The cinder blocks had just covered everything and made it too dangerous to sift. But I was able at least to stand on the sidewalk beside my property and kind of make peace with it. Not really.
What do you mean make peace with it? I mean, what was that like?
What was it like? We need to know what it was like. when your town is incinerated, it sucked. I'll save you some time, Matt. It sucked. Have you covered like natural disasters? Have you been like in the aftermath around people who have lost everything?
Yeah, and I've covered many. I was in Lytton in the aftermath of the fires as well. I've been in Christchurch after the earthquakes and the mosque shootings. I've been in Japan after the tsunami. I am a natural disaster chaser.
I've been in that situation once. It was after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. I didn't go right after. I was there like a few months afterwards, but it absolutely was. I'm there as a reporter sifting through the rubble, talking to people who lost everything. And I felt like scum. I felt like a vulture. What is your practice? Like, how do you engage with people when you're doing that kind of work?
I mean, it's the same with the stabbings almost, right? Like, it's just people experiencing unimaginable tragedy. And you have to go up to them and say, how do you feel? Or essentially, you're asking how they feel, but I would try to avoid that turn of phrase. But it's so difficult. Basically, I go in not asking questions and not on the record from the start. It's the same with Saskatchewan. I was in there not taking notes, not with a notepad, not taking my phone out, and just talking to people about how they were doing, basically. I'm always very careful while we're asking questions about what happened to say, but how are you? And how are you coping with this, basically? So it's clear that we're concerned about their well-being as much as we want to hear the story. So it's such a tricky thing. And those clips are a little bit triggering because I heard that so many times in Ukraine as well. But I also think that speaks to a little bit of a difference between TV news and print journalism and those kind of things, because TV they want an emotional reaction because they want to see that emotional reaction on camera, right? So, I mean, that is the crux of what they're looking for.
Yeah, that's the payoff. That's the money shot to that question. It works on radio and it works on television. And I don't want to be totally closed. I think that certainly there is perhaps value in expressing human compassion and solidarity. I don't know, it doesn't have a high informational value. It's not like, oh, we're really curious what it's like. But what is the difference between expressing compassion to somebody when you're trying to report on what's happened and performing that compassion? Performing, like, you know, you're getting something out of it. You're getting that shot of a person, you know, the prurient interest or whatever it is, to watch somebody whose life has just been destroyed and there they are on television breaking down. Is that about us feeling for them, or is there something else that's a little bit nastier at work in what we enjoy or why that's compelling to watch? It makes me really uncomfortable. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that from the informational point of view, what is valuable? Getting to questions about the government response. How about a question like, your home was just destroyed by a natural disaster. What do you want to ask the government about their climate change policy? I mean, maybe that would be a good question to ask people in those circumstances.
100%. I mean, it's such a tricky situation, and you're right. There is something nefarious about going into these situations and, I don't know, sifting through people's emotions to try and get the reaction that you want. So I always feel awful going into these situations because I feel like I'm emotionally manipulating people, because there's an end game for me here. I want the information so I can write a story. There's a very difficult line that you need to tread where people are vulnerable in those situations. So are they telling you that because they feel like they have to, or they're feeling vulnerable, or is it because they are actually ready to talk? And I think that as a reporter, you have to be so, so careful that you're not just taking advantage of someone's grief and they're speaking to you because they are just being exploited compared to if they do seem ready to speak. I think we just have to be so hyper aware of our surroundings. And you're right, we need to ask smarter questions. We need to go beyond the how do you feel, what was that like, what did you know, like those very basic questions where you're just looking for an emotional response to what would you like to say to the government after something like this happens, or what needs to happen next, what can we do to support you, those kind of things I think are more important in those kind of situations.
Yeah, Let's give benefit of the doubt to the team at The Current and to Matt Galloway. I mean, these were obviously people who consented on some level. It's just that they're consenting at such a weird time. I think the Litton interview took place sometime after, but the first interview was just right in the wake of this. So people are right in their grief. There's value, I suppose, for victims of these disasters to kind of know that we care, you know, so maybe they want to talk to the media for that reason. And then there's practical things. We can raise money and things like that. So let's assume that, you know, precautions were taken to make sure this person really wants to talk to the media. But I don't know. Like, I think you can ask people how they're doing and, like, not include that in the broadcast, you know?
But also, like, think about your audience as well. What are the clips that go viral after something like this happens? What are the clips that your readers and your viewers and those kind of things share? It's always the emotional ones. It's always the ones that people are breaking down in tears. It's not the, we think the government needs to do X, Y, and Z. So, I mean, in one way, they're kind of just giving the audience what they know that they want or share, I guess.
What's the story that I click on? It's the one like, here's a slideshow of the devastation of this next climate disaster, right? Like, it's like, oh, damn, that, oh, wow, before and after pictures, you know? It's not all coming from a good place. It's not all coming from, like, oh, that's a shame. Like, there's something going on there, and I think you can't let the newsreader off the hook, I suppose. The audiences are playing a role in this gawking that's happening. It's pretty ugly.
It can be, honestly. And, like, we're all looking for that shock value or trauma porn, you know? Like, when something like this happens, we're going to be clicking on those kind of, like, really horrific stories because that's, it's just who we are. I mean, you can't blame. I think it's easy to blame the broadcasters for this kind of thing, but that's what gets the clicks. And unfortunately, this is the industry that we're in and we're looking for the clicks.
Oh, God help us all. That is Shortcuts, Ashley. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
We're on Twitter at CanadaLand. I can be emailed about anything you heard today at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Ashley, where can people find you? Where can they find your reporting?
You can find me on Global News, or you can find me on Twitter at Ash_Stewart_.
I want to make a quick announcement. We are hiring here at Canada Land. We are growing and we are hiring. We're looking for an office manager. We're looking for a managing editor, and we're looking for an editor in chief. It is time. It's been years now that I have been podcast host and reporter and publisher and our editor in chief. It is too much. I'm getting burned out. I think it's time for a change anyhow. It's time for somebody else, somebody new, somebody different, somebody with their own editorial vision to take the reins and step into our top newsroom job. All of those jobs I mentioned are now posted at canadaland.com/jobs. Journalists listening right now, have a look. Tell a friend. This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our production coordinator is Andre Prue. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we're doing here, if you want to help support independent news in Canada and get all kinds of great stuff that we want to give you, click the link in the show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. We rely on your support.